Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, July 15th, 1999. In the fireside room this morning is Barbara Rossing. Today's session is number 99-8 and is titled Ecology in the Bible, Ecofeminism, Apocalypse, and the Tree of Life. Let's listen in.
Roll the tape. Let's get started here. I don't know how many of you have been here for the other parts in this little series, but you don't have to have been. Let me just kind of recap. We're looking this week at how the Bible might be a resource for ecology. I'm an environmentalist, an avid environmentalist. I'm also a New Testament scholar. I teach in Chicago at the Lutheran School of Theology, and I just finished teaching a course with an Old Testament scholar on the Bible and ecology, and that's what I'm sharing with you. And I'm still doing a lot of my own thinking on this because I actually have an article that is due August 1 that I haven't started yet. So I'm hoping you'll help me on that. But anyway, this is what I'm currently writing on and working on. So yesterday, picking up on what Jim Martin Tram did on Tuesday, we looked at a shift in the agricultural economy of Israel that was taking place in the 8th century BC. And this is according to the thesis of Marvin Chaney. I actually found an extra copy of the article that I will put on reserve if any of you are interested in it. It's this one called Bitter Bounty. And that title sort of says it all, is that with this shift to a more intensive kind of farming, there was more bounty overall in absolute terms, but it was a bitter kind of bounty because it also involved a social stratification, increasing gulf between rich and poor in Israel, between the elites and the peasants who were being squeezed on their land. It was a shift to more of a cash crop, export kind of economy, and they were trading their crops with the maritime empire of Tyre. And so yesterday we looked at the tirade against Tyre in Ezekiel 26 and 27 and in other places too that talk about how that when there's this shift from subsistence farming, little peasants on their little plot growing different kinds of crops, to this more export-oriented economy forced by the elites, then people had to grow more vineyards for wine and more orchards for olive oil that could be then traded away, and they had less for themselves, and it was a more stratified kind of economy. Today, I want to follow up on that, first in the Old Testament, and then shift into the book of Revelation, which is my specialty. We'll do a very quick tour of Revelation from some of these perspectives. But I want to introduce the whole issue for the prophet Hosea, and then again for Revelation in sort of ecofeminist terms, because I'm also a feminist. And I want to just think for a minute about what happens when we start using metaphorical language in Scripture, specifically these metaphors of portraying cities as women, as feminine figures, where we personify inanimate objects like cities, rivers, trees, into living figures. And I think this can be both a bane and a boon for ecological theology. But let me just start by asking you about personification, this whole issue of when you take an object and sort of personify it, attribute to it human characteristics, give it possibly, and speak of it in human kinds of metaphors. Both Greek and Hebrew, the Old Testament is Hebrew, the New Testament is Greek, both of these languages have gender as a fundamental part of the structure of the language, as do most languages of the world. German, for example, everything is der, die, or das. If a fireplace is masculine, der fireplace, it could be die Buch, you know, a feminine, this is a she and this is a he. Grammatically, it doesn't mean they have gender, it just means that everything in those languages has a grammatical gender. Same thing in French, it's le or la. Everything is masculine or feminine. Now, what that means is that in those languages, then, if you start personifying things, attributing them human characteristics, masculine things, fireplace, let's just say, I mean, that's arbitrary, would be personified as a man. This is a mighty fireplace or whatever. And feminine things would be personified as women. As this is a feminine book, then she's a mystery to me. She's an important study, you know, or whatever. And that's how you personify things. As I was thinking about this session, I was thinking about this old French song that I learned when I studied French about the River Seine, the one that flows through Paris. You know, you've probably seen the River Seine. it happens that that is a feminine river in French. It's La Seine. So therefore, in the song about the river Seine, they sing about it, La Seine est aventureuse. She's a adventurous woman. She sort of twists and turns all the way from Châtillon down to Mairie. And then at the end of the song, she's portrayed as a lover, a woman lover. The La Seine est une amante. That's the feminine word for lover. And her masculine lover is Paris. Et son amant, c'est Paris. And you can do that because the river is feminine, and then and Paris happens to be masculine, the city of Paris. And so these two are having a romance. The river and the city are having a romance, and the one is feminine, the one is masculine. That's what the song sings about. I mean, the river is really personified as this woman lover, who sort of snakes her way, you know, around. And it's really interesting, though, because in Greek, rivers are masculine. So you wouldn't sing about the Seine River as a woman. In Greek, if you were singing about it, you would sing about it as a man. But cities are feminine in Greek and Hebrew. You know, the gender is somewhat arbitrary, but it leads to a whole sort of world of personification that things take on the gender of the language that they're in. And so cities then in the Bible are personified as feminine figures. It's the opposite of the Seine River and Paris. Now, I wanted to just stop and ask for a moment what you think about this whole idea of personification. We don't do it a lot in English. The only sort of example I can think of is the song Old Man River. You know, I think, and I don't know if the notion of the river as an old man was just sort of started with that musical, what is it? Is it Showboat? No. Showboat, okay. Is that the first that we have in English of rivers being considered men and Old Man River? Was that made up? Or do you think about the river in your town as a man? Or how, you know, do you have any other examples of it?
What about Joy to the World, Let Earth Receive Her King?
Uh-huh. Yeah, so that's a good example. Uh-huh. Yeah, earth is feminine in these languages. Yeah, so that's a carryover from the Greek or Hebrew. Great. Uh-huh. Other stuff? Okay, ships are women, yes. And I was saying at the first session, you know, really? You know, give me some examples. And I said, well, Lady of the Lake. Okay, good example. Our ship right here on Lake Chelan has a woman's name. She's a Lady of the Lake. Yeah, and they probably talk about her in fond sort of feminine terms. You know, she's a sturdy one, you know, whatever. And other ships as well tend to, the Queen Mary, the Queen Elizabeth. Okay, yes, hurricanes.
The tradition was that you don't allow women on ships.
Oh, really? But I've seen the movie Titanic. There are women. Yeah, okay.
In Eskimo, they would do a ceremony to remove the scent of the woman.
Really? Huh. And was the ship then viewed as feminine in Eskimo?
The kayak was viewed as an extension of the person.
Huh.
It was part
okay.
of them. And they were going out to hunt whales and seals, and they didn't want the seals and the whales to be jealous of their wives.
Ah, okay. So they were going to have a relationship with the seals and the whales. Okay. Yeah, and I think, I mean, another example would be the Statue of Liberty in French. And the Statue of Liberty, as far as I know, my shaky history, it came from France, didn't it? And in French, the noun for liberty is feminine, la liberté. And a lot of these abstract nouns are. And so it's natural then that liberty is personified as a lady, Lady Liberty. So that's an example. Uncle Sam, our country, is personified as male. But we don't do it very much in English. Most other languages do it a lot more. Think of St. Francis's beautiful hymn, you know, All Creatures of Our God and King, how each verse has like, dear Mother Earth, who day by day unfolds rich blessings on her way. It's brother sun and sister moon. That whole song is singing about the various elements of our ecology, our planet, as brother and sister, and sort of personifying them in order to underscore that notion of kinship. And I think that's one thing that is a benefit of personification, is then you can convey this idea that earth and the sun and the moon and the rivers are our brothers and our sisters. And that's certainly a very strong theme in Native American theology. I've got a booklet here. Unfortunately, it's out of print. I couldn't order it, but it's authored a really nice ecological Bible study by a Native American guy named Stephen Charlson, who's an Episcopal bishop used to teach at Luther Seminary, then he went to be Bishop of Alaska, now he's going to be president of the Episcopal Seminary. But he talks a lot in this book, Threads of God's Creation, about the importance of this sense of kinship with nature. And that's part of what you achieve by calling the salmon your brother or your sister, and the sun is your brother.
Aboriginal people all over the world think of kinship rather than stewardship.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, let's talk about that. I mean, what do you think of this idea of kinship? Is it helpful to you to think about the elements or of nature things as your brothers and sisters, of earth as your mother?
It certainly is a different way of, you relate to them differently if you feel that. Like.
And what kind of, how do you relate to them?
I think you cherish them more.
Uh-huh.
I had a class once, and the whole time we debated, it was called The Sacred in the Wilderness, or is it the sacred and the wilderness?
Uh-huh.
And just in or and, we went around and around. But it was fascinating. We used Moses from the Old Testament. We used Black Elk Speaks. We used Otto, the German thing.
Oh, yeah, Rudolf Otto. Uh-huh.
Otto and John Muir, you know, trying to get...
Yeah, and certainly Black Elk would use that brother and sister, that kinship language. I don't know if Muir does. He certainly loved nature. It's one way. What are other pluses and minuses? I mean, there are some downsides to it, too, and we need to talk about those. But others? Uh-huh.
Isn't that just our throwback to matriarchal religions, pre-Christian matriarchal religions? The whole basis was the basis of motherhood in the earth.
Yeah, and that's the downside for Christians, and I think we have to talk about that. I mean, that we discussed that at the first session, whether you can, as a Christian, talk about Mother Earth or not. Now, St. Francis did, dear Mother Earth, who day by day, but for some that's very threatening because it's a throwback to pagan religions. I wrote an article for the Lutheran magazine a couple years ago called Love Your Mother, and it was picking up on the bumper sticker. You know, you used to see where it has that bumper sticker around Mother's Day. You'll see those Love Your Mother, and it has a picture of planet Earth, the beautiful blue planet, and it's been proclaiming this idea that Earth is our mother. And I wrote about that and got a lot of, not a lot, but several, you know, angry letters saying, you know, this is neo-paganism, you know, you're going back to fertility cults and stuff. So, but then a pastor at the first session said that at funerals he does use the image of Mother Earth because it's the idea of someone returning to Earth that's very comforting, that this is not a, you know, an alien place for us, but it's the Earth, that it helps people, Christians, to think of Earth as Mother. So I don't know what others of you think on that. Uh-huh.
Well, I just see our issue with men and Christianity is the need for men to control women, which is a whole different thing than Christianity. As far as I'm concerned. I mean, that's the earthly part of Christianity, and probably not real okay with me.
Yeah, there has been, in both the Old and the New Testament, there's a definite tone of patriarchy. I mean, all ancient cultures were patriarchal. The Greek world, more so or as much as the biblical world. I mean, this was the idea. So then, the downside of portraying Earth as a woman, as a mother, is you exploit and abuse her. And Dan Spencer was sharing some quotes, even from 17th century scientists, about how this is a mandate to sort of exploit and abuse, not necessarily to cherish a woman or a mother figure, but to exploit. Anybody else on personification? Well, carry that idea with you, because what I want to do now is look at some of the biblical personifications and see what those images do for us and how maybe we can turn them around, flip them around from how they are usually read, to see if there's something that we can draw on for an ecological reading of Scripture. How many of you majored in English? Did any of you? You got to help me here. Or no English. Okay, nobody. Great. Well, I didn't either. Okay. But what we're doing with all this is, these are metaphors. When you say the earth is a mother, it's obviously not literally a mother. You know, it's a metaphor then. And it communicates something. I mean, what comes to mind when we say the earth is a mother? Why would we do that? What are we communicating?
Nurturing.
Uh-huh.
Everything comes from.
Yeah. Okay.
The earth.
Giving life.
Giving life. Okay. So it's a way of helping us see qualities of Earth that are like mothering or whatever. We're using, we're not saying the earth is literally mother. We're saying that sort of mother is, in metaphorical terms, that's the vehicle for communicating something, and earth is the tenor of the metaphor, and then we're applying things about earth or about mothers to earth, and it helps really highlight these elements that we're talking about. That's what we're going to see with biblical metaphors as well. Specifically, we're going to look at these metaphors of the cities of Israel and Judah, or the lands of Israel and Judah, being portrayed as women, as feminine figures. Because that's, starting with the prophet Hosea, and that's where we're going to start now, it became a really significant strand in the Old Testament that then was picked up in the New Testament, that a way to talk about Israel was as a woman. Okay, so let's take a look at Hosea. Now, where to find Hosea? Hosea is after Daniel, and Daniel is after Ezekiel. It's back in the prophets, after the Psalms and Proverbs and stuff. It goes Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, and then Hosea is the next one. Page 859, great. Okay, it is 859, good. All right, if you have one of these new RSVs, it'll be page 859. Two, we're going to look at Hosea 2. Okay, what other pages do you have? 776
in the black RSV.
Okay, in the black RSV, we're talking 776. Okay, great. All right. These prophets, and it was sort of a brilliant metaphorical move. Not a literal, but a metaphorical move for the Old Testament prophets when they want to critique Israel and Judah's unfaithfulness. They began, beginning with Hosea, to speak of this as adultery. So you personify Israel and Judah, the nation of Israel, as a woman, and that becomes a way of talking about the covenant relationship between Israel and God, because then you use the metaphor of marriage to talk about that. That God would be the husband and Israel is the wife, and they're married because God has a covenant with Israel. We looked at Genesis 12 on Monday and saw that covenant being established that continues throughout the Old Testament. Okay. So then what it means is when Israel is unfaithful to the covenant and strays off to other gods, other practices, then the metaphor for that is adultery. So what they're really talking about is idolatry, but the metaphor that can be used when you've got the wife and the husband married to each other is adultery. And that's what we'll see here in the prophet Hosea. He's the pioneer of this metaphor. Would somebody be willing to read Hosea 2, 1 through 6? Or no, let's do 1 through 8. We got time. 1 through 9. Just if somebody only wants to read part of it, you can stop whenever you want, and then the next person will start reading. I know we've got some readers here. Or you can skip verse 1. There's a lot of bad names if you're saying. Start with 2. If you don't want to do all those names in 1, start with 2.
Say to your brother, Ami, and to your sister, Ruhama, plead with your mother, plead, for she is not my wife, and I am not her husband. And she put away her whoring from her face and her adultery from between her breasts, for I will strip her naked and expose her as in the day she was born. And make her like a wilderness and turn her into a parched land and kill her with thirst. Upon her children also I will have no pity, because they are children of whoredom. And their mother has played the whore. She who conceived them has acted shamefully. For she said, I will go after my lovers. They give me my bread and my water, my wool and my flax, my oil and my drink. Therefore I will hedge up her way with thorns, and I will build a wall against her, so that she cannot find her paths. She shall pursue her lovers, but not overtake them, and she shall seek them, but shall not find them. And she shall say, I will go and return to my first husband, for it was better with me than now. She did not know that it was I who gave her the grain, the wine, and the oil, and who lavished upon her silver and gold that they used for ale. Therefore I will take back my grain in its time, and my wine in its season, and I will take away my wool and my flax, which would cover her
nakedness. Okay. Now, metaphorical language, I mean, this is beautiful biblical poetry. The very sort of element of poetry of any kind is that it's what we call multivalent. It has multiple meanings. I mean, they could just say what they meant in prose and not use metaphors if they had wanted to be, you know, exactly straightforward, like a prescription or like a recipe or something. I mean, they know how to say what they mean. But when they launch into poetry and metaphor, what that means is you can have multiple levels of meaning going on at the same time, many valences or many meanings. And I think that's what's going on here, that at the one level, it's an indictment of a woman who has been faithless to her husband. And the husband is angry and is threatening her and is saying, you know, if you don't stop this, I'm going to have to beat you up and kill you. Now, in a patriarchal culture, this is legal. This is the way that that husbands would speak about their wives. In our culture, hopefully, I would say this metaphorical language is very problematic, first of all, because this kind of behavior would be illegal, and we don't want to think of God as this kind of threatening or battering husband figure. The book that has helped me the most on it, I would say, is this one that I wrote on the board by an African-American scholar, an Old Testament scholar named Renita Weems. Very interesting book. Unfortunately, I forgot to order it for the store. This is the story of my life. I forgot to order everything, but I'll just tell you about these books. And it's called Battered Love, Marriage, Sex, and Violence in the Hebrew Prophets. And she traces how this metaphor starts with Hosea, where here I think it's not actually that God intends to carry out any of this stuff. It's rather the threat uses an exhortation to Israel saying, you know, please cease this unfaithfulness. You know, otherwise I'm going to do this or this. But God has really no, you know, isn't wanting to batter and kill her by thirst and strip her naked. It's rather this plea to come back to God. But in some of the other prophets like Ezekiel, that's where it gets really terrible. In Ezekiel 16 and 23, the chapters that fortunately we never read in the lectionary, where the Jewish people also, I mean, these chapters are almost pornographic and certainly dangerous. Okay, so you're all flipping to them right now. I heard that. Okay. No, in terms of the violence that God, and by the time of Ezekiel, see, the exile was inevitable. There was no way to avoid it. And so then what it is God is planning to carry out this killing of his wife by dismembering her, first of all, passing her around to all the nations for a gang rape kind of scene, and then dismembering her, torturing her. I mean, it's a terrible image in Ezekiel 16 and 23. That's the sort of carrying it out, the metaphor out to its kind of end consequences. That's how dangerous it can become. But so in terms, in feminist terms, I think we have to say, whoa, these metaphors are problematic. You know, we don't want to see God as this kind of God, nor is it helpful because we don't view these as legitimate kind of relationships to beat your wife and kill her simply for unfaithfulness. But I want to invite you, so one possibility that some feminists say, not very many though, is that we just have to throw out these texts. They're unredeemable. Now, I would almost say that of Ezekiel 16 and 23. I don't see any way to redeem those two chapters. But this one, I think this is where the metaphor is starting, and you can see there's a lot going on. Notice, a couple of things. First of all, a translator has to decide in English, because English is the problem. English is the odd man out as far as languages. Here I'm saying odd man out. that we don't have gender. Anybody, a German or a French person reading this in their language doesn't have the problem that we have, which is the question of you have to decide when you're rendering these pronouns, for example, in verse 3, or I will strip her naked. In English only, you have to decide whether to say her or it. All other languages know that you use she, but you really mean it, because you're just using she because it's a feminine noun. And so you could downplay the whole gendered idea of this text by translating it in English with it, since that's what we normally do for lands and cities. So it would be, or I will strip it bare and expose it as in the day it was born and make it a wilderness and turn it into a parched land. I mean, that works, because actually what's being spoken about here just as much as a woman is a land. A parched land. I mean, you see what it's like around here when the sprinklers don't get turned on. We quickly turn into a parched land, or when there's no rain. Land needs water. It's parched and thirsty. You can kill a land from thirst just as you can kill a person. And I think that's part of what's going on here, is that it's the land of Israel being talked about. And it's English that is so much foregrounded, the feminine aspects. Because look at down in verse 5. I mean, a lot of it, of course, it starts out with this image of whoredom, but then it... The issue is, for Israel said, I will go after my lovers. They give me my bread and my water, my wool, my flax, my oil, and my drink. I mean, these are crops that are being talked about. This is agricultural imagery here. If you turn to chapter 9, hold your finger here because we'll come back to this, but flip over to Hosea 9. I mean, trying to figure out what is this whoredom that Hosea is critiquing here. Do not rejoice, O Israel. Do not exult as other nations do, for you have played the whore, departing from your God. You have loved a prostitute's pay on all threshing floors. It seems to be, it's because this is such indeterminate language. I mean, we don't know what's going on, and Old Testament scholars argue every which way on this. The traditional interpretation that it has been that what the book of Hosea is critiquing is idolatry. That Israel is going after foreign gods, the Baals, the Canaanite gods, and that Hosea is calling them back to faithfulness to God. I want to propose an alternate possible reading here. This is one that is suggested by an Old Testament scholar named Alice Keefe, and she argues the thesis that Israel's foreign lovers in the book of Hosea are not so much these Baals, these fertility gods, as they are Israel's foreign allies and trading partners. That is Tyre, the Phoenician city up the coast through which flow all this trading stuff. And that in fact, what Hosea is critiquing is the same as what we talked about yesterday in that Marvin Chaney article about the shift that was taking place in the agricultural economy of Israel at this time in the 8th century, where they were shifting from a subsistence kind of farming with each person on their own plot of land with this mixed sort of inefficient way of, you know, everybody growing, you know how peasants are, and it was shifting to a more controlled or command kind of market economy where the elites of Israel were forcing or persuading people to grow more cash crops, more the wine and the oil for trade to Tyre, so that they would, in return, the elites would get the luxury goods, the gold and silver and other stuff that came through Tyre. And that's part, in Keefe's hypothesis, that's the tirade that Hosea is also echoing here. The alliances with foreigners that he's crying out against, the whoredom that he's talking about, isn't just this at the level of religion, but it also includes the level of political economy and Israel's trading alliances. And the whoredom included this cash cropping for export. That's her thesis. It's in a book called The Female Body, The Body Politic and the Land, a socio-political reading of Hosea 1 to 2. It's an article. Anyway, and I find that a really interesting thesis. So I just throw that one out to you, that actually there might be a lot more going on ecologically in this prophetic critique, much more so than just the idolatry and Israel as this unfaithful wife. It might be some of this this agricultural astute observation that Chaney at least argues is in those other texts as well. Where you have to then what I do, and I already sort of showed you in this translation back to Hosea 2, is then the idea of nakedness isn't so much a woman's body getting stripped of its clothes and gang rape kind of images or whatever. It's rather a land being stripped of its vegetation, a land being deforested or stripped of its agricultural cover. And you can argue that. I mean, I am arguing that. I'm not saying it's the only way to read nakedness by any means. But for example, then in verse 3, you know, where it says, or I will strip her naked and expose her as in the day she was born. Nakedness can also be used metaphorically of lands and landscapes. And I'll show you a couple texts just quickly here, because it's so important, I think, in the book of Revelation also to see that the nakedness, when the whore of Babylon is stripped naked, it doesn't necessarily have to be read just as a woman's body. It can also be read as a landscape. But I could show you, you know, all you have to do is get a concordance and look up naked, and you'll see, yes, it's used a lot literally for people's clothes being taken off, but it also can be used of lands and landscapes. And one of the places, just a couple passages here, if you want to take a look, hold your finger here at Genesis 42. Sorry, I'm making you do all this jumping around here. Come back next week and we'll go straight through one book, namely Revelation. But this is a jump around week here. Genesis 42. This is in the story of Joseph and his brothers in Egypt, you know, how they sold him into Egypt, and then there was this terrible famine. Joseph was in charge of the grain stores, and finally his brothers come begging for grain from Egypt because they're so hungry up there. And in chapter 42, Joseph has recognized his brothers, but they haven't recognized him. And he decides to sort of test them, and so he's kind of saying accusations to them. In verses 9 and verse 12, Joseph feigns suspicion of his brothers, and he says, you are spies. You have come to see the nakedness of the land, which means the famine of the land, the fact that there was nothing growing on the land anymore. So nakedness can be used metaphorically to talk about how there's nothing growing on the land. The nakedness of the village green up here at Holden that has no grass anymore. I mean, it's so something, a piece of land that no longer has anything growing on it can be naked. And again, in verse 12, again, Joseph says, no, you know, Joseph's brothers protest, we're your servants. We've never been spies. And Joseph says again, no, you've come to see the nakedness of the land. So this is just to show you how the idea of nakedness is used also in lands and landscapes. And there's other texts like that in Lamentations and the Psalms and stuff. So that's what I'm arguing is the kind of nakedness image in Hosea, if you do this sort of ecological reading. The threat that if you continue this new pattern of cropping, part of it, Cheney points out, meant that they ceased to observe the fallow year. They didn't let the land have a rest. And the threat then is if you keep farming like this, you're going to be stripped bare before you know it. There's not going to be anything growing. So that's one way to read these images then, as more of a land or a landscape and less as a woman and her body. Okay, comments or questions before we go to the book of Revelation? What do you think about that?
In Hosea, dropped it now, but Israel is referred to as he. Like
oh, yeah. He switches then, calls it Ephraim. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, it's very interesting in Hosea because what's striking is that in the Hebrew language, even the word you has a gender. So you can tell if he's writing to you as to you a woman or to you a man. And yeah, the gender then switches. In the early chapters, he's writing to you as a woman. Then in these later chapters, when Israel is this vine here beginning in chapter 10, you can see it switches to the masculine. Israel is a luxuriant vine that yields its fruit. The more his fruit increased, the more altars he built. Yeah, it switches to masculine. So there, Israel would no longer be married to God because God is always masculine here. But yeah, it's different images. Hosea is rich in various metaphors for talking about Israel and the gender shifts. In verse 11 of chapter 10, Ephraim was a trained heifer that loved to thresh. Whoops, now it's back to feminine here. It goes back and forth. Chapter 11, when Israel was a child, I loved him. Out of Egypt, I called my son. You know, well, so how can Israel be both God's wife, God's son, you know, a heifer? This is metaphor. It's a shifting back and forth in order to point out different aspects of Israel and to call Israel back to faithfulness. So, there's all kinds of metaphors used in Hosea. The gender shifts there. Uh-huh. Anybody else? Has Hosea and this idea of the wife and her body been troubling to anybody else? Okay. Maybe you've never thought about it.
Uh-huh. How do we know it's metaphors and not problems and
transformation? Well, this is where we need an English major here, but because poetry tends to use metaphors, and Hebrew poetry as well. I mean, the Bible is full of metaphors, wonderful ones, like in Isaiah, you know, where it says, the mountains and the hills will break forth into singing, and all the trees will clap their hands. Well, literally, you know, the trees are great around here, but they don't clap their hands, you know. And I love the mountains and the hills, but I've never heard them singing. So, you know, it's this prophetic language is typically very metaphorical to talk about God and to talk about our relationship. So it's not simply a problem of translation, because I think there's more than that. I mean, they're actually using imagery, but it's part of it is translation.
I just meant with the he/she thing.
Yeah. Okay. Right.
I thought Hosea was demonstrating God's faithfulness, though, by marrying an unfaithful woman and demonstrating his continued fear.
Right. That's how it starts out. Hosea the prophet was actually called to enact or embody God's faithfulness. So certainly this marriage metaphor is a primary one in this book. But the question is then, what is the whoredom that he's sort of supposed to correct? And whereas that has typically been interpreted just at the religious level as worshiping foreign gods, Keefe is arguing, and I find somewhat persuasive, this idea that includes more. It includes these alliances with foreign powers and with foreign trade. That's her thesis. All right, let's go to Revelation here for a few minutes. And here you've got more of this feminine imagery. And most people are shocked when I tell them that I work on the book of Revelation and that I think it's a very rich ecological resource. You know, because they'll say, I even have this one, I heard Al Gore speak one time when he was just a senator before he was vice president, and he wrote an ecological book called Earth in the Balance. And he was talking about in South America where the ozone hole is getting bigger over the South Pole and how there's now some mutant animals there. I don't know what they are. And he said, it's as bad as a nature hike through the Book of Revelation. You know, which, and it's like, well, what could be worse than that? You know, I mean, in Revelation, it is true that you have all these sort of mutant animals. You have strange creatures. You've got a lot of scary kind of violent sounding language. You've got waters turning to blood. I argue that a lot of that imagery is invoking memories of the Exodus and the plagues that brought Israel out of Egypt. That were nature-related plagues, and that Revelation is drawing on that whole tradition, that people are called now to undertake an exodus out of Rome and its political economy, just as the people were called out of Egypt, and that the memory of that is triggered by having plagues that are similar to the Exodus plagues. But there's a lot of scary things going on in the book of Revelation, yet I think this is a really important book, and I think it can be an ecological resource for us. Most significantly, because at the end of the book, God comes down from heaven to earth and makes a home on earth. It's, in my opinion, the very opposite of this idea of a rapture, you know, where people are going to be snatched off the earth. I was just reading a book, one of those Left Behind novels that I think are terribly wrong, with this idea that people are going to get raptured. And I don't think that is scriptural. I don't think that's what Revelation is about. Rather, at the end of Revelation, if anything, God gets raptured down to earth and comes to make a home on earth in the midst of the holy city. And the theme verse for Holden this summer is from Revelation chapter 22 about the river of the water of life and the tree of life. And we'll look at that at the end today. So I think there's a lot of ecological resources there. If you look at the New Jerusalem vision as a really earth-centered kind of promise of our future with God. But you've probably never heard that reading before because it's unusual. But anyway, let's just take a look at a few passages from Revelation where I think there is more possibility for an ecological reading than we've typically seen. First, chapter 12. This is kind of a fun little one here. And why I'm making this connection overall is that some of the imagery of Hosea and the unfaithful wife gets picked up and then applied to the whore of Babylon, and we'll look at that in a minute. Also, the tirade against Tyre that we saw yesterday in Ezekiel 26 and 27 gets picked up in Revelation, now used as an indictment of Rome and its economy. But first, chapter 12 here, one of the many chapters in Revelation where we see a very vivid feminine figure. This is the story here of the woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, the crown of 12 stars. We don't know who this is. It's mythic language. She gives birth to a male child. A dragon tries to eat the child, but then this child is snatched up to heaven. The woman gets these wings of an eagle to escape. It's very vivid. Sometimes Catholics have said this is another Christmas story. This is Mary giving birth to Jesus. You could read this text at Christmas. because it is a mother giving birth to a child. The typical more Protestant interpretation that Martin Luther started, that most scholars actually now agree with, is the idea that this is the church, the woman is the church. But anyway, it's a very sort of mythic, vivid picture of the war that takes place in heaven. Then Satan, who apparently was up in heaven until this point, gets really mad. War breaks out in verse 7. Satan gets kicked out of heaven and cast down to earth, so he's really mad, really frustrated. Things get worse on earth after this, as Satan now stalks the earth until chapter 20, where he's locked up. So there's a lot going on here. But what I wanted to point out to you is the personification of earth here as a feminine figure that we don't often see in Revelation. But even though she's not called a mother, earth is certainly called a woman or a feminine figure here. But it's usually translated as it and not as she. If someone would be willing to read verse 13 to the end of the chapter, you'll see it.
Chapter what?
Oh, Revelation 12. I'm sorry. So we've skipped over 600 years, 700 years. We've now shifted without much transition, much good transition from Hosea to Revelation.
So when the dragon saw that he had been thrown down to the earth, he pursued the woman who had given birth to the male child. But the woman was given the two wings of the great eagle so that she could fly from the serpent into the wilderness to her place where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time. Then from his mouth the serpent poured water like a river after the woman to sweep her away with the flood. But the earth came to the help of the woman. It opened its mouth and swallowed the river that the dragon had poured from his mouth. Then the dragon was angry with the woman and went off to make war on the rest of her children, those who keep the commandments of God and hold the testimony of Jesus.
Okay, which is us. And then Revelation 13, which we won't look at this week, we'll look at next week, is the sort of personification of the Roman Empire as these two beasts. I don't know if you call it personification when it's like beastification of Rome. But anyway, the two beasts that are powered by the dragon. So, but we skip right over it. Did any of you in verse 13, I don't know how many translations we've got here, did anybody in verse 16, sorry, have the earth as she? The earth came to the help of the woman. No. She opened her mouth.
RSV
is it. Anybody got she? You do? Can you read yours?
Contemporary English version.
Okay. And that's, I think that's an American Bible study one. Okay, what have you got there? You want to read?
You want 16?
Yeah.
But the earth helped her and swallowed the water that had come from the dragon's mouth. This made the...
Okay, so you don't actually have the earth as feminine, but it's helped her. Okay. Yeah, because just to say in Greek, you could just as well. I mean, this is a translator's decision. It sounds like all of our translators have decided the same way, which is to call earth it. But the Greek pronoun is she, because earth, it happens, is a feminine noun in Greek. Earth is the feminine noun gay, you know, and there's no reason it's feminine. It just happens to be feminine, like tables happen to be masculine or whatever, which then is the origin of this whole Gaia hypothesis for earth. And so there's a sense in which, I mean, if it were in German or French, it would be the earth opened her mouth and swallowed the river. But it's hard to know in English how to render this. But this is an example of where you do see, I think, a certain level of earth personified, because only people and animals have mouths. And it definitely is the word for mouth, stoma, there. And so the earth opens its mouth or opens her mouth and swallows the river to save the woman. So it's earth actually taking an active kind of a saving role here, which is a tradition throughout the Old Testament. I mean, already at the Exodus, you had earth opening its mouth and swallowing up the Pharaoh, or it's the water opened its mouth and swallowed up Pharaoh's in Pharaoh and his chariots. In 1 Corinthians, Paul talks about death is swallowed up forever. So this swallowing idea is a saving kind of image, and here it's earth as a full-blown, I think, personified figure opening her mouth and swallowing the river from the dragon. So there's a lot of images here in chapter 12, very lively personified and metaphorical images. I apologize that I don't have time to give you my whole sort of interpretation of the book of Revelation. The whole issue with Revelation, just like with the prophets, is what do you read literally and what do you read metaphorically? Just to say briefly, I do not read Revelation as a script for end time events. I do not interpret it as, say, Hal Lindsey does, as Tim LaHaye and Jerry Jenkins do, these authors of the Left Behind novels. I don't think it's meant to be literally a timetable for end of the world events. I think rather a lot of that language is metaphorical, starting with the image of, that's obviously a metaphor. We don't think of Jesus literally as a sheep. And rather, I think it's written as a very astute critique of Rome in the first century when it was written at the end of the first century. And it's using kind of apocalyptic imagery and languages to critique Rome and invite us out of Rome, to call us to undertake an exodus out of Rome into God's new Jerusalem. So let's just take a look at Revelation 17 and 18, the Babylon vision. A highly personified vision. Let me just, I've got some transparencies here of Babylon. You know this whore of Babylon. You've read about her. One of the most famous images of the whole book. I've got her. Here she is. We've seen so many pictures of her. There we go. Okay. The whore of Babylon, Revelation 17, 1 through 4. The description of her is she's riding on a multi-headed beast. Now, this one doesn't have her exactly riding. She's kind of squished the multi-headed beast. But this is the multi-headed beast is the Roman Empire. That's what we see in Revelation 13. It's pretty clear. Seven heads, because Rome has seven hills. Everybody knew that. And the beast is supposed to be really ugly. I think this beast is kind of cute, but the whore of Babylon is dressed in a red dress. She's got a lot of jewelry on. She's holding in her hand the cup of the fornications of her abominations. She's clothed in purple and scarlet. She's a very vivid image. This is Martin Luther's picture of the whore of Babylon.
Scarier than the beast.
Yeah, I know. So, but this is a flyer that came in my mailbox, and in the actual flyer, yeah, it's a blue background, and she's got a red dress on. No, this stuff comes around. This is Seventh-day Adventist tract, trying to get you to come to a class on Revelation, and they'll certainly tell you what Revelation means. This is the image of the whore of Babylon from Martin Luther's, what we call the September Bible. When he translated the Bible from Latin into German, he had his friend Lucas Cranach illustrate each of the books of the Bible with a woodcut. But for all the other books of the Bible, it was only one woodcut per book. Suddenly, though, when he gets to Revelation, it's a woodcut per chapter, and it's really wonderful to look at these. I like Cranach's art a lot. He's the one that did the triptych in Wittenberg. And I think this is a pretty vivid image here. Picking up on Durer, he's following Albert Durer's imagery somewhat. But you can see there, she's riding. Now this beast looks maybe a little scarier. Here, I've got to get that into focus better. The seven-headed beast, we need to be able to really see these creatures here. The multi-headed beast, she's got her red dress on. Notice she's riding side saddle, because that's how women ride in Luther's time. And all her jewelry. The one thing that you notice about this image that's kind of funny is Luther had Cranach put on her head the papal tiara. So he's clearly showing the whore of Babylon as being the Pope, the Roman papacy. Okay, so you do, in chapter 17, get Rome really personified as a feminine figure. The deal is, though, this is as far as most of us read, is to have this image of Babylon portrayed as a harlot. And I think, though, what I want to argue is, like Hosea, it's important to read these images not so much as women, but as cities, as empires, as landscapes even. If you read them as women, it's very problematic, because the whore of Babylon is going to end up being stripped and tortured and killed. You see that in Revelation 17, 16. And even though Rome is evil, I don't think we want this kind of violence inflicted on any women. in predicting the demise of the Roman Empire, it says, the 10 horns that you saw, they and the beast will hate the whore. You probably have this translation now. They will make her desolate and naked. They will devour her flesh and burn her up with fire, for God has put it into their hearts to carry out his purpose by agreeing to give their kingdom to the beast until the words of God will be fulfilled. Some feminist scholars, and this book is in the bookstore. I really like this book. It's called Searching the Scriptures by Elizabeth Schussler Fiorenza. It's just edited by her. It's a series of essays, mostly on New Testament books, a few apocryphal books by feminist scholars that are really good. There's also the Women's Bible Commentary. It happens that the woman, and there's a debate among feminists right now about the book of Revelation. How misogynist is it? How bad is the imagery? The woman who wrote on Revelation, I don't agree with, but I think her article is very interesting, very provocative. A woman named Tina Pippin, who says this verse, Revelation 17:16, is the most dangerous verse in the whole Bible for women because it seems to sanction God calling on animals to rape and violate and strip a woman and burn her up and kill her. And this verse has been used as a mandate for that sometimes in the history of interpretation. For example, it was used to justify the burning of witches in the, what is it, 16th, 17th centuries. But I don't think this should be read primarily as about a woman. And that's where I think, remember what we talked about with Hosea, that you can either, you know, foreground the women stuff or you can foreground the landscape and empire stuff. That's what I think we should do here. In fact, I would translate Revelation 17:16 as follows. The 10 horns that you saw, they and the beast will hate the whore. They will make it a wasteland and bare, or a wasteland and denuded. But it's this idea, like in Hosea, of a wasteland and a bare land that has nothing on it. And I think what happens is you've got to decide whether you're going to primarily read as a woman or a landscape. At the end of the chapter, you see it does say, the woman you saw is the great city that rules over the kings of the earth. I mean, he's meaning Rome. He's talking about a city, but he's using a feminine personification to do it. What happens if you read this stuff, if you keep reading as a woman, let's see, I've got some transparency here if I can find it, that has one portrait of this scene in chapter, in verse 17, 16, as taken as a woman's body, and this is what it looks like then, is you keep it portrayed as a woman, she's being burned up, she's being stabbed and stripped. This is, I think, dangerous kind of imagery to promote, even of the Empire Rome. Much better, I think, is what Luther does, which is he had Cranach then shift. Why can't I find anything? There is Babylon. Here. Shift then in chapter 17 at the end, and then going into chapter 18, shifts the imagery from that idea of a woman riding on a beast to Babylon as a city, thankfully. Because I think that's what the end of 17 and all of chapter 18 are about. Is that the Roman Empire is being threatened with destruction as a city, like the it says at the end. So here what you've got is the merchants of the earth are weeping and wailing because no one buys their cargo anymore. Well, we've got about 5 minutes left here, so let me show you this stuff here. That I think far more important to the critique of Babylon or of Rome in Revelation is chapter 18, which we don't tend to read as much as 17. It's a critique of Rome's political economy, of the whole trading empire and the idolatry and the violence. This economy where you have to have money in order to be able to participate, where the merchants, the shippers, the mariners are getting richer, but at the cost of the other nations of the earth, at the cost of the land. I think there's a critique of logging here. We know that Rome was notorious for its deforestation of conquered lands, and it had conquered everywhere, bringing logs. We can read that from classical authors who write about the wonder of Rome and how the ships come here loaded with logs from all parts of the earth. So that there's one passage even that says, in this guy named Aelius Aristides, who loved Rome, he's quite the orator, he says, so many ships come here carrying such big logs that it seems, and then he names the lands from Arabia, from North Africa, that people there must have to come here to beg for their trees, which have been stripped bare. Mm-hmm. And he's talking about it in a positive sense, but that's what Rome's political economy was like. That's the devastation of the land. The center of Revelation 18 is this section here that I think is very important. that draws on Ezekiel's oracle against Tyre. This is where the kings of the earth who committed fornication with Babylon, again, this metaphorical idea of harlotry, and lived in luxury with her will weep and wail over her. And again, I would read all of this as it. I should be reading as it. Will weep and wail over it when they see the smoke of its burning. They will stand far off in fear and of its torment and say, alas, alas, the great city, Babylon, the mighty city, for in 1 hour your judgment has come. The very center of the chapter is this next part, the lament of the merchants. And remember, we saw in Ezekiel there was the lament of those whose big ship was taken out on the high seas and then sunk, all the cargo that they lost, all the stuff that, say, Judah and Israel had traded away, their grain and their millet, their barley. This is picked up in the cargo list here. The merchants of the earth will weep and mourn for Babylon since no one buys their cargo anymore. Then in verses 12 and 13, this lengthy list of 26 cargo items. Of course, as always with the book of Revelation, the question is, what do you read literally and what do you read metaphorically? And I'm going to read this literally. But you could just as well disagree with me and say, no, it's all metaphorical. It's just Old Testament quoting, you know, it's nothing particular about Rome. There's a lot of legitimate interpretations of these books. Because this is the question, is where do you see metaphor and where do you see literal? And I'm just doing one particular reading that's my own, you know, reading what I'm arguing is literal. But I'll make a case for it, but I don't want to claim this is the only way to read Revelation. I mean, you can also make a case for that script of end time events too, but I think it's a critique of Rome and its political economy and that we can learn something from this. Because notice the cargo list includes all these fine, expensive items. Twice wood products are mentioned, all kinds of scented wood. This is hardwood from North Africa, silk and scarlet, all kinds of scented wood. Oh, I already did that. All articles of costly wood, bronze and iron, the metals, everything's being mined from the Roman conquered provinces. And then the last item on the list is slaves, that is human lives. I mean, even this trade of Rome includes so much that it's even a slave trade. And we know that about 20% of the people in the ancient world were slaves. And there was a great deal of the economy was based on slaves. So John is critiquing this whole political economy that he sees as raping the earth, raping conquered lands. It's critiquing Rome's violence. He's calling us out of this. Revelation 18:4, he says, come out of it, my people, or come out of her, my people, so that you don't take part in this sin. Come out of Babylon in order to participate in God's new Jerusalem, which is an alternative kind of city. It's the opposite of everything that Babylon was. The New Jerusalem vision is where we see the tree of life. It's where the water of life is given without price. Everyone, even if they don't have money, it's given without cost. The Greek word is dorion. Everyone will be able to partake of the water of life. There's enough for everyone. And it's a really alternate kind of vision of God's future that I think is really an intriguing one for us. Certainly a vision of heaven, where we're going to go when we die, but more even than that, I think it's a vision that we're called to live in terms of now, as the call in the Babylon vision is come out of Babylon and be citizens of a different kind of a landscape, a different vision of the world, and live in terms of God's new Jerusalem vision now. And I think that's the intriguing ecological possibility for us, is if we start reading about the river of life, the waters of life. I've been using this week this Roman Catholic bishop's pastoral letter on the Columbia River Basin, this huge watershed that we're living in right now, that talks about the Columbia as a river of life. And what does that mean if you start to see the rivers of your communities in terms of this idea of revelation of the river of water of life, that wherever the headwaters of your river are, just, you know, take it in terms of Revelation 22. It's the river that's flowing from the throne of God, from the heart of God through your community. I think that says something to us ecologically about how we're called to live and about how we envision our life and the tree of life. Okay, we got a couple minutes for discussion. I'm sorry I talked so long here. I get into Revelation and I can't stop. But how, responses, questions, comments? Where did you see the imagery? Uh-huh.
I guess in reading it, I've never considered it personally as a woman, but as the city and in describing it so ugly, like having to do that because the city was so corrupt.
Uh-huh. Good.
So I've never
good.
Personalized it or thought of it as a woman, but always as the city.
Good. That's great.
let me, I can just show you a couple other images too. I mean, in the ancient world, everyone thought of their city in feminine terms, but I would agree with you, not as a woman. Every city in the ancient world, I'll just show you this, had a personification of their city that looked like this. This is the city of Antioch on the Orontes. City is feminine. But how these cities were, they would wear on their heads the mural crown of the city walls. The cities were viewed as these feminine figures that were protectresses, but they never were actual women. They weren't talking about women. It was the city, but she was personified as a feminine figure. But the problem is when we take it as a mandate for violence against women. If you try to take it literally, I mean, here's one really funny transparency. This is it's much more beautiful in the actual tapestry, a Flemish tapestry depicting the marriage of the lamb. If you view New Jerusalem as literally a bride, and because Revelation 21 says she's a bride, she comes down from heaven like a bride adorned for her husband. In chapter 19, verse 7, it says, the marriage of the Lamb has come. His bride has prepared herself. Well, here she is, and here's the Lamb, and these two are getting married. That's the problem with a literalist interpretation of Revelation. You know, this is a wedding that would not be legal in most states. Well, anyway, hopefully, I gotta let you go to coffee break here, but hopefully you're gonna have fun playing around some more with these metaphors. Start thinking about how much of the Bible might actually be ecological, that we're just not seeing that way because it's couched in metaphors, and start reading some of these more in terms of lands and landscapes. Tomorrow we're gonna look at Job and the whirlwind, shift to a whole other book, look at a nature writer named Bill McKibben, who's got a wonderful book about how he thinks the speech of God to Job from the whirlwind is one of the most ecological visions in the whole Bible. So we'll look at that. Thanks, everybody.